This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. Rebecca, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to start off by giving a shout out to Kate Cairns from Rutgers for hooking us up and for her guidance in general on the topic. I know so little about your research, and now I'm parenting daughters who are moving on into the high school year. So I've become intensely interested, as I am not knowledgeable. So I'm grateful that you're here, and I'm quite grateful to Kate for her help in getting this all set up. I look forward to talking about your work later on in the episode. So first I want to talk about a tweet that's been making the rounds yesterday and today. It's up to like 3,000 retweets and 7,000 likes, and it's by...
And 5,000 hashtags.
Yeah. Well, that's how you get it out there, Gabe. That's social media 101. But anyhow, it's from Professor Kakali Bhattacharya, I hope I pronounced that right, an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership at Kansas State University. She posted a Twitter thread that blew up on academic Twitter. Basically, the thread was a guide for qualitative researchers on how to engage criticisms of small n's in their study. So I guess, Rebecca, I guess you could speak to this.
And Joe, specifically from peer reviewers.
Was it specific?
Wasn't it? Or, well, I'm sorry. No, not really.
No, it was just a general. I think it was just a general thing, unless I misread it.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
It was a guide. I guess if you're a qualitative researcher, there's always someone who says, how much can you learn by talking to 20 people?
Yeah.
I guess that's like a fact of life, I guess, for qualitative researchers. And this is like news you can use. And it was sort of a how to deal with that question. And first of all, does anybody else want to summarize it, or shall I have the honors?
You're doing great.
I'll do it. Okay. So she starts off. It's a long Twitter thread, so I won't go through the whole thing. But she starts off with advising that researchers not fall into the trap of justifying qualitative research using quantitative criteria. And I think that's great advice, right? They're fundamentally different endeavors. And then she says, you know, ask your inquisitor why they're concerned with a small n, which is also great advice, right? That's basic active engagement in a discussion. And then she moves on to say, not any of your explanations should include justifying how your sample size could be used to generalize somewhere down the road, or any other explanation where you pin qualitative against quantitative research. It's an oppositional conversation without any decent end goal. And this is the point where she starts to lose me and where I start getting a little bit critical. And she gives, the thread continues where she gives people a script to follow. And my comment on that is, be careful here. I mean, a lot of us have read this thread. So if you go to your job talk and give the script, we'll be like, yeah, I saw that too on Twitter. And here's where you might get into trouble. And stop me if you think that I'm misconstruing what she says that she advises people to do. Basically, she's telling qualitative researchers to pivot towards sort of meta-theoretical differences. And sort of frame the issue as one of differing perspectives. And you're supposed to sort of tell your inquisitor that their question is positivist / post-positivist, and that you're operating with a different perspective and you're not concerned with sample representativeness. And here's another quote. She says, again, the key here is to invite them to your inquiry playground and remind them that this is an unfamiliar space for them. They can resist all they want, but you hold firm that you will not defend your methodological decisions using the criteria of goodness for quantitative work. And then there's a few more arguments about how to justify small sample sizes with the number of pages the transcript it produces. I don't think that's very effective. It's not convincing. I'm not going to dwell on it, but here's my thing. Is this good advice when a qualitative person is faced with challenges about small sample size? She says, never talk about generalizability. You know, go to meta-theoretical differences, make them play on your playground, don't talk about, you know, don't talk about your research in quantitative terms. I think that's bad advice. I think it's sort of fostering like a non-productive dialogue where you're not trying to negotiate your differences. You're not talking about how quantitative and qualitative work can work together, but rather you're presenting it as very hard differences, and it's one that I don't think would serve you well if you had if you were on a job talk or a tough dissertation committee. Did you guys like that piece, or what was your opinion?
I can say two things, perhaps.
Yeah, go.
I did like her piece. I liked especially the very beginning, which you seem to have liked as well, that to ask what's motivating somebody by that question. And then I do feel that she sort of seems to then assume a certain motivation and go with that route instead of recognizing that there might be different kinds of motivations behind their question and that you should be sensitive to those. So I would agree on that point. But I also feel that I think often qualitative researchers are asked to sort of justify what they're doing through a lens that doesn't really fit with the qualitative sort of underlying approach. And so I can understand how she's saying, you know, that we shouldn't have to justify the work that we do through this different set of lenses that doesn't really fit with qualitative methods, and that it's our job to then explain that. And I feel that there's, I agree that we need to, that it's valuable to have conversations between, you know, where there might be meeting places between qualitative methods and quantitative methods. However, to have those conversations, I think first you do need to have some of those philosophical conversations about some of the beginning places that they come from.
Right. How do you engage that challenge? Like if someone, because you're a qualitative researcher, if somebody says, what are you going to learn from talking to 30 people? What do you feel is, how do you engage that type of criticism?
Well, I would probably come at it to some extent like this woman has, to say, well, you know, from a qualitative perspective, 30 participants is actually quite a large number. And, you know, often I've tried to have more than one conversation with interviewees, for instance, if I'm doing interviews, because you have so much more depth over more than one interview. So then you're sort of looking more for the deep rather than the broad. You know, again, I would be interested in what was concerning them about that 30 and what was sort of lacking from that 30. I would make it clear that, you know, I'm not trying to sort of suggest that this 30 is representative or generalizable in a massive way. I would do some of the things that she's suggesting, actually. I would. One thing, though, just one more point, and it's something that I don't see really raised in her discussion here, is that I do think it's fair to ask questions about the choice of the sample, right? So for instance, you know, if I'm, say I'm doing a book about girls and I've interviewed, you know, a certain number of girls, and some people might not feel that the sample size is large enough, but maybe a more significant question is, you know, have I included diversity in my sample?
Gabe, did you want to?
What I didn't like about the thread, I mean, aside from just the whole thing that it seems like a marriage counseling session, is that I think she hits a real own goal with saying, oh, you should say you're positivist or post-positivist, and, you know, I'm subjectivist, blah, 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 which regardless of how she means it or regardless of validity of that is basically, you might as well just save time and say, don't hire me, don't publish my paper, don't do whatever it is that I'm seeking for you to do, because people are going to hear that and think it means, I don't believe in facts, you know, and that kind of epistemological issue is not necessarily entwined with qualitative versus quantitative research. I don't think it's necessarily the case that every quantitative researcher is a naive empiricist, and every qualitative researcher is, you know, completely thoroughly phenomenological. I mean, it does tend to be the case that quantitative researchers are interested in patterns among easily observable things that they necessarily have to be somewhat naive about and take for granted, even if they try and problematize them. And I could give you a big list of ones who do. But it's also the case that qualitative research is comparative advantages meaning. But that doesn't mean that you have to say, oh, everything is totally subjective and I reject. It's just a way to shut people down and say, oh, okay, you know, I'm going to leave this talk as soon as I can. You know, as soon as the Q&A starts, I'm just going to bail because I don't want to be part of this nonsense.
I would pick up on one thing that there was one tactic in that string of advice that I thought was not very good advice. And it's that, and I mean, she's a senior person, right? She's an associate professor. So I'm a little bit surprised to see it coming from that. But my own experience has been, you know, after a little while in this business, you've run into people who deal with criticism by affixing labels or giving you mountains of citations, you know, that more than you could expect them to know.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you see it enough, it feels like a dodge. Like, I wouldn't do that if I were a student. You know, like everybody gets snowjobbed once by the person who rings off 30 articles that they say you should have read, but you didn't. And then you look it up and you're like, that's not at all what the article said. And then after that, you know, all that meta theory and lit review, it's not an effective argumentative tactic, I think, for people who I think are serious.
Yeah, I think that there's two. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And also there's just the idea of just because you're giving me a list of citations doesn't mean I find them credible. You know, so I would say she does an interesting thing where I think that there's like the scientific epistemology issue of, you know, how valid is a source of knowledge. And then there's also the kind of, you know, show offy aspect. And unfortunately I think she's basically right in seeing some of this, the implicit motive in some of these things of being basically, oh, you only did this much.
Right.
And, you know, and it's almost more about measuring the effort.
Right.
And so saying like, well, I have 1,000 pages of field notes, you know, and so, you know, even though you have 2,000 people in your data set, each is only one line in a CSV file. And, you know, as measured in kilobytes, I have more data than you, you know. It's kind of a silly argument, but I think she's actually right that it might be effective in some cases. But, you know, I think the real argument is not like getting into side arguments about, you know, positivism. I think that's a terrible loser. Rhetorical strategy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The real way to handle it is just say, when you're concerned about generalizability, you use quant methods. And when you're concerned with exploratory approaches and or, you know, unpacking meaning, you use qualitative approaches, and they can be complementary with each other. And, you know, that's generally a good way to answer things. And I've found that, like, when I'm giving a talk or something and somebody answers a question, they don't actually care whether you know the answer or not. They just care, are you creative enough to think about how you would go about knowing that? And people generally love it if you say, like, well, that's actually a case where the other methodology would be good. And, you know, I'm primarily a quant, and I've answered questions with saying, well, that's where we need ethnography. And I think, you know, it'll be a much more effective tack. Likewise, if you're qual and somebody asks you a question and says, well, that's actually a case where quantitative studies would be able to help us,
yeah,
rather than just saying, like, well, you're a positivist, go away. You know? Even if you say it in this very, like, well, what I hear you saying is that you're a positivist, yeah, but where I'm coming from, you know, with the, like, very I statement type stuff, you know, it's still effectively saying, you know, I reject your epistemology and the horse it rode in on.
Well, it's a character argument at the end of the day, right? You're pigeonholing someone and then you're attacking the pigeonhole in which you had them. I think it's just not convincing. Like, if somebody asks you that, either they don't know anything about qualitative research, and so that's not going to be convincing, or if it's a job market, they might want to see if you just understand, you know, how to talk to quants, or maybe they have some type of genuine concern. But in any case, I think ultimately, the tactic that she recommends is great if you're a tenured professor and you don't have to convince people. But if you actually are in a position where you have to convince people, you're in a much better position to find common ground and try to be persuasive and bring people over to your side rather than argue against them.
You know, I hear you. I hear what you guys are saying. There's one other sort of maybe side to this, and that's, you know, and this I've heard this given by people where they just sort of talk about mixed methods in a really sort of easy way, right? As if it's as if these things you can just sort of go back and forth really easily. You can combine them both in a project. And, you know, I would be interested in, say I had a candidate in for a job interview, and I would rather they be able to recognize some of the deeper philosophical differences that sort of exist. Maybe if we could look at it as a sort of continuum on the farther sides of the continuum, mm-hmm. right? And to recognize that there are challenges sometimes in terms of mixing these things rather than just sort of suggesting that you can kind of just throw it all together and that there's no sort of significant underlying differences. Because to me, that would suggest a superficial understanding.
Interesting. It's like, wow, you can't make every, there's no way to sort of hit all the high points. I guess like the moral that I get from this is like, it depends on who your audience is maybe. And what plays well in one room might not play well in another.
Well, maybe it also goes back to that original thing she says, which is to find out, to ask them, right? A little bit more about their inquiry. You know, where is their inquiry coming from? And then maybe rather than follow a script, which is what she's sort of going towards. And I agree, it's problematic to go towards a script when you've just said, maybe we need to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then to sort of build on where they're coming from in forming that question, which may mean talking about philosophical differences, or it may mean talking about how there are places where there's possible linkages, or it depends on what kinds of questions you're studying, those kinds of things. I mean, maybe the problem here and the thing that's gotten you guys kind of stressed out is that she seems that she has this sort of more scripted approach. And she does also say, this point about how, you know, she sort of ramps it up when she says that the inquirer is unconvinced, right?
Oh, and
that's when she starts to sort of amp it up a bit and sort of dig in terms right. of maybe a binary position.
Right. For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.